Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us today. In case you hadn't figured it out, Team All of It likes food. We like to eat, we like to cook, we like to eat, and winter is a great time to cozy up and chow down. We've invited cook and author Allison Roman on to talk about her favorite wintertime stick-to-your-ribs recipes. Allison is a cook, writer, and author of the best-selling cookbook Dining In. She's a biweekly columnist for the New York Times cooking section, as well as a monthly contributor to Bon Appetit. Allison, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we have a recipe expert here. Do you have a recipe question for Allison Roman? Need to figure out how to give an old staple some pizzazz? Have a stew that's got you stumped? Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Okay, before we get to anything else, we have to talk about hashtag the stew.
We do.
So you published this recipe in the New York Times cooking section, and it's called Spiced Chickpea Stew with Coconut and Turmeric.
Yes.
More than 2,000 people gave it 5 stars, and then it went viral on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this stew.
It is a journey, the stew. I did not anticipate this happening. I thought it to be a really nice stew. It was delicious. I didn't think it was going to blow up the way that it did. It is delicious. It is comforting. I've spent a lot of time the past few weeks talking about why I think it went so viral, its popularity. And honestly, I think that the internet really helps in that. I think if something catches, it kind of continues to catch like that, but it's cheap. It's made with mostly pantry staples. No matter what you're cooking with, it's all going to kind of end up looking the same. And I think that people really like that. It feels like a community.
Grub Street said it has taken on a life of its own.
Yes, it has. It sure has.
So, but there are some important things to know about this recipe. You note that it's important to avoid low-fat coconut milk.
Yes, don't do that. It just has it's lower fat, and I think with most things lower fat, it means less delicious, but also it's going to affect the texture. So low-fat coconut milk tends to be a little bit watery, and I know that some people have had issues. They say, is it a soup? Is it a stew? And I think that if you're using the full-fat coconut milk and you're cooking it the right way, then it is definitely a stew. But low-fat coconut milk is one of those ingredients where no matter how long you cook it, it's just never going to take on that richness.
It's never going to get the kind of
It's never going to stewify, if you will. Yeah.
So what are the ingredients? Just so if people are thinking, like, what is this stew? What is this magic?
So it's basically a mixture of garlic, onion, ginger that you saute, add some chickpeas, cook those down. I take a little bit out of the pot once they've got a little frizzle frazzled. They're not quite crispy, but they've got some texture to them, reserving to garnish later. And then you add your coconut milk and your vegetable stock or chicken stock or whatever you like. Cook that down until it becomes really nice and stewy and thick. Oh, the turmeric, obviously. I forgot that. And a little chili flake for spice. And then once that is sort of at the texture you want, and what helps that get that stew texture is the body of the chickpeas. They kind of break down. They release their starch in addition with that, you know, very delicious fatty coconut milk. And then at the end, you add a handful of greens. So I like to use kale. You can use spinach, Swiss chard, sort of any dark leafy green you've got kicking around. And then to finish it off, some yogurt. I've seen a lot of people add lime, which is nice.
Oh, I bet that's like a little bright.
Yeah, I like to do mint. You can also do cilantro. It's pretty flexible in its spirit, which is my kind of recipe.
We've got a call for you already.
Oh,
Catherine,
yay,
from Manhattan on line two. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thank you for your program. I recently got a new cookbook, and two or three of the recipes call for white miso paste.
Mm.
And I had trouble finding it until I discovered, or one of the people at the store and Whole Foods helped me discover it was in the cold department, you know, with milk and so forth. So it appears to be a very healthful food, and I'm wondering what types of foods or recipes I could add it to other than the ones that are already included in the recipe. Like, would it be good in salads? Would it be good in stews in general? Or how might I use it since it's such a good food, healthful food?
Yeah, I mean, miso to me is one of those ingredients where you can add in many different ways and never really know that it's there. Kind of like, you know, anchovies, a little bit of Parmesan, fish sauce, anything that has that really high concentration of flavor and saltiness. It's kind of like a secret ingredient. So you can add a spoonful to stews and soups and braises, and it'll just kind of add a really nice depth of flavor if you're feeling like, oh, this isn't as delicious as I want it to be. I also will use it in vinaigrettes and sauces. It's excellent blended in with things like tahini or almond butter for like a very thick, rich sauce if you're, you know, doing without dairy. What can't you do with it, really? I mean, it's also really nice if you thin it out and you can use it to slather a piece of meat with and kind of slow roast it in the oven. It gets really nice and caramelized and is to me really, really great cooked as well raw.
Catherine, so much. Thank you so much. When you make it, take a picture of it and send it to us.
Yeah, we want to see.
We want to see. Let's go to Bonnie from Brooklyn. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. What's your question for Ms. Roman?
Sure. I just found an incredible source for farm-raised oxtails, and I feel like they deserve, you know, the proper treatment. I made them once so far, and I feel like I overcooked them. Like, I stewed them to the point where the meat was falling off the bone, mm-hmm. which kind of defeats the purpose, you know, for me. There's something about, like, sucking on that bone. So I'm curious as to what I can do to really make a good oxtail. Not too soupy, but, you know, hearty as well.
You know, I will say I am not an oxtail expert. I would like to be. I love eating them. I'm less familiar with cooking them. But my general rule of thumb with braises is I prefer a stovetop braise to an oven braise just because I feel like you can kind of control the liquid and the soupiness, the thickness of it. And you can also just check it more frequently, especially if you're concerned with it becoming too dry or not dry enough. And it gives you the opportunity to kind of peek in there every now and then and just kind of see what's going on. But I also really love that bone part. So I would braise it till the point of it falling apart. And then I would also, you know, you suck the marrow out of the bone. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. For me, I'm more of like a braise the oxtail, pick the meat, turn it into a ragu or something kind of person. Mm-hmm. But right. I think if you're looking for...
Do you have a suggestion for a base?
I mean, I think any sort of hearty red meat they all kind of get along with the sort of onion, garlic, tomato paste, red wine, or chicken stock base. And then from there, you can kind of add spices or chilies or citrus zest or miso even, you know, to kind of take it in a different direction.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck with your oxtails, Bonnie. Let's go to Dina in Manhattan. So, Dina, you have a question about hamburger.
Yeah, I know it's not really good for us. That's why I put an onion. I chop up an onion, and I use kosher chopped meat. So I was wondering, instead of onion all the time, and I use Grape Leucone mustard and some pepper, I do it like twice a month, twice a week. What could you recommend that I could put in instead of the onion? Because it's getting so boring, and Grape Leucone mustard.
For like a hamburger?
Like a ground meat?
Yeah, regular hamburger. Yeah, just a regular hamburger that's kosher.
Oh, like to, well, I mean, to like eat like as a hamburger or to like just stir fry?
I think
like,
to add into, she's sick of the onions.
Yeah,
she's
done
with
the
onions. She wants something else in there to give it some pizzazz.
Yeah.
Give it a little excitement.
Miso. No. you know, I mean, it really, I'm a huge fan of the Allium family. So if I, you know, I'm going to say if you don't want onion, use shallot or garlic, but I'm assuming that's also what you're not looking for. But I think that you can add things like herbs are going to be really helpful in adding moisture, which onions do. So onions are adding moisture as well as flavor. So if you take that out, you have to take that into consideration. So you can even add a little bit of liquid depending on what it is that you're making with the hamburger meat to kind of compensate for that lack of oniony liquid that it's giving off.
What are some good herbs, you think?
Parsley, chives, you know, ground. I cook with a lot of ground pork, and that takes really well to things like, parsley, chives, cilantro, even depending on what direction you're taking it in. But, you know, they will also add liquid and moisture to help it from becoming super dry. Also, you can play around with the ratio of fat, you know, wherever it is that you're getting your meat. If you find some that is naturally higher in fat, maybe you don't need the onion.
My guest is Allison Roman. She's a New York Times columnist and Bon Appetit contributor and the author of Dining In. We are taking your calls 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Do you need to spice up something that you make all the time? Do you have any soup or stew issues? Allison can help you out. So one of the things that's great about your Instagram account is the food you make. It's really... It's beautiful. It also looks accessible,
mm-hmm.
which I think, and I mean that in the best way.
No, I hope so.
Do you do your own styling, your food styling?
I do, yeah. So I am not a food stylist, but I do style all my own food for the New York Times column and for my cookbooks, just because for me, it's very important for the reader to look at a photo and then look at the dish that they make and have it look the same. And I think because I'm intimate with the recipes, I understand how they should look. It also helps me write the recipe better to give you indicators on what you're looking for, how something should feel. Should it be loose? Should it be thick? Should it be golden? And kind of translating that to the page so that's something that you're seeing and feeling like, okay, that's what my food looks like also.
So we all know if we're taking a picture, don't take it from below.
You do, not your best angle. Don't take any picture from below. Yeah,
what's
that's a no-go.
What's the best angle for my food pictures if I want to put them on my Instagram?
You know, I think the traditional mentality is overhead because that's how we see food, right? It comes to our plate, our table. We look at it from above. I've been sort of, you know, playing around with different angles just because I think that I personally am fatigued with the overhead top-down image. But also when you're sitting at a table, you see it sort of like at a three-quarter view. Mm-hmm. So that to me is kind of fun to play around with. But it depends. And honestly, no matter what the angle is, it's about the lighting. If the lighting's not good, the picture's never going to be great. So there's a lot of food pictures I've taken that will never see the light of day that are just for my eyes because they're just really not that great.
People who listen to this show know we like food. We have restaurant critics on all the time.
Yes.
Cookbook authors on all the time. We did a whole segment of calling in about ramen in the city, where to go for ramen.
Yeah.
Is that something you can make at home? Is it tough?
I think it's tough. Yeah, I think I sort of have a rule about where I like to eat, especially. And I say, like, I will always seek out a restaurant making food that I won't make at home. And it's not that I don't think I could make it at home. It's that I won't make it at home. Mm-hmm. It's an hours-long process. You really need to, I think, know what you're doing. I could probably make a pretty okay version. I don't think it's going to be as good as somebody who knows how to make ramen and has been doing it for their whole lives. Or even a year. They will have a better time in it than I. So I could probably make a pretty good cheater's version, but I wouldn't try to pass it off as authentic.
So that's one of those things you think maybe best to go out to
a
spot.
There's a handful of things where I think, you know, maybe not something that is, you know, unless you're really willing to give it the time and the research and do it justice, I would say leave it that to the experts.
I do want to ask you about your creamy tomato soup recipe because it's supposed to go down to 27 on the weekend.
Is it?
Yeah, one of the evenings. So I think like creamy tomato soup and a grilled cheese just sounds like heavenly to me.
Yes. That is a deep cut recipe. That is many moons old. And I had to actually think about if that was really mine, and it is mine. it was one of the first recipes I think I ever did at Bon Appetit. This is 100 years ago.
What kind of tomatoes? What am I doing?
I used canned tomatoes, I believe. And I think that's because, to your point, when you want the tomato soup, it's not, you know, the middle of July. You don't want like a hot bath of tomato soup. You want something like that in the wintertime where tomatoes aren't in season. So using those tomatoes, I think I roast them in the oven first.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Can we confirm or deny? Well, that's what I would do now. But using something like a canned tomato soup, cooking down the tomatoes either in a skillet or a pot or the oven to concentrate the flavors, kind of give them that like juicy, sugary, caramelized tomato flavor before turning it into a soup, which of course has a lot of cream, probably some butter, salt, pepper.
Not for our lactose intolerant friends.
Definitely
do you use
not.
The whole tomato can, the canned whole tomatoes?
Oh, yeah.
That's what I have to go for. Okay.
And that's kind of my go-to anyway, no matter what I'm doing. I'd always rather take a canned tomato and make it the texture I want it to be than trust whatever's coming out of the can.
Are you ready for some more calls?
Oh, I'm ready.
Okay, let's go to Gail on line two, who's calling us from Queens. Hi, Gail.
Hi there. I'm enjoying this segment. Thank you so much.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you, Gail.
I am an aspirational vegan, and I cook lots of dried beans, and I have lots of experience cooking dried beans, but I would like to know your favorite method for making dried beans more digestible.
Gail, you're speaking my language. I am obsessed with dried beans. I make them weekly. They very much excite me. I really love a dried bean.
That was not a sentence I expected to hear this morning when I woke up.
I know. Tell me about it. I didn't expect to say it, but here we are. So I kind of make them differently every time, depending on how I'm planning on cooking for the week. In terms of digestibility, that is a code that I have not yet cracked. But I will say that the more that I eat them, the more my body likes them. I think that the digestibility, there are certain foods that agree or disagree with certain people. And I think it is a very personal experience. And I am not a nutritionist, and so I could not speak to any sort of technical thing that you could do to make them easier on your body. I can tell you how to make them very delicious, but it sounds like you got that on lockdown.
I do want to hear you. Tell me.
I basically, you know, I'll take a dried bean, cover it with water, add, you know, any sort of halved garlic. I tend to put in the whole head of garlic, just have it lengthwise so you expose the cloves. Mm-hmm. Every time people see that, they're like, well, what do you do after? You just pick it out, you know, or the cloves get really soft and they kind of melt into the broth. But olive oil, salt, pepper, some dried chilies, maybe a bay leaf, you know, oregano, thyme, anything like that. I'll sometimes sneak in a few anchovies or something so they kind of melt into the liquid as they cook as well. Or a Parmesan rind or anything that's going to give them kind of that meaty, salty flavor.
We did get a call from Billy from Manhattan who has a suggestion about the miso paste.
Hey, Billy.
He said, as a marinade for salmon, Luger's dressing for chopped meat for hamburger.
So oh, Billy's great. Billy's all over that chopped
Billy's
burger.
All over it. Let's go to Norma on line 5, who's calling us from South Orange, New Jersey. Hi, Norma.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, I keep kosher and do not mix dairy products with meat, but I often find interesting recipes that will ask me to put in yogurt or other dairy products. Is there any substitute for that?
Well, you know, I think it really depends on what the thing is. So, you know, if you come across a recipe for a meatball, for example, that asks you to add yogurt or ricotta or something like that, you'd want to add, you know, something like extra breadcrumbs that have been soaked or, you know, egg, if I guess that counts as dairy. You're not going to mix that either. But, you know, in terms of like a marinade or something, I would think you're better off skipping that without looking for a replacement. So if it's like a yogurt marinated lamb or something, you would just kind of maybe switch to an olive oil based marinade or something. Something that has fat, because that's also what's happening there, but will help carry the flavor. And that's why dairy is so good for that, because it adds moisture and richness and fattiness. But something like olive oil in the right application will also help you get there.
Let's go to Sheila, who's calling us from Darien, Connecticut. Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
How
Can
are
you? Hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I live in Darien, and I'm trying to make some more Asian food, and I cannot find black bean paste or soy glaze. Hmm. And I'm also trying, I make my own yogurt, and I can't find yogurt starter anymore. Whole Foods doesn't carry it, any of those things anymore.
Yeah.
I just don't know where to go to get it.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, my answer is always the internet for this type of thing. And I think that it's really beautiful that no matter where you live, you could buy black bean paste if you order it from the internet. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to live in a place like New York to be able to cook that kind of food. So I use the internet often as a resource for things that are harder to find for me even here. I mean, you can kind of get everything you need. But if I'm looking to place like a bulk purchase, or for any of people that read my recipes that look for something that they can't find in their hometown, I always suggest looking on the internet because you can find it there. They'll ship it to you. Buy a few jars so it'll last you a while.
We've got a question from Howard who didn't want to come on the air or was busy or something. But he said, Howard says, he's from Sheepshead Bay, he hates cilantro.
Mm.
Any substitutes?
Howard. You know, it sort of depends on what it's being called for. You know, if it's something like the stew or something and they say add cilantro, I would add mint. Oftentimes, I use parsley as a substitute for cilantro. It doesn't quite have the same flavor. Cilantro is a very aggressive, pronounced flavor that I happen to love, but I know a lot of people don't. And it's kind of just like experimenting with other herbs and depending on the flavor profile. You know, is it, you know, are you substituting with chives or parsley or mint? Sometimes tarragon, depending on, you know, what it's being called for. But it's okay to also leave it out. But I would say for the greenery, parsley is a pretty good bet. It's also got pretty mild flavor.
My guest is Allison Roman. She's a New York Times columnist and Bon Appetit contributor and author of Dining In. She's taking your questions, 212-433-9692. Okay, Joseph is in the East Village, and he has a quandary.
Uh-oh.
Hey, Allison. Walking home last night, I bought a case of persimmons in Chinatown.
Wow.
So I have 24 of them. They take forever to get ripe. But
yes.
Do you have any recipes I could use them for?
Which kind of persimmon?
Also.
Okay. Which kind of persimmons? The one, the Haichias or the Fuyus?
They're the smaller squat ones.
Okay. So those actually, they don't. Won't get as soft as the other kind.
Right.
So I enjoy eating them a bit firmer, almost like an apple or a pear. So There's a great, delicious salad in my cookbook, Dining In, that uses pears and blue cheese and walnuts that have been cooked in maple syrup with a little chili flake, which is really, really nice. But, you know, I sort of, if I have a fruit like that lying around, especially if you've got a case, then just kind of experiment. And any time that you would use an apple or a pear, use a persimmon or use it in conjunction with each other. I don't think that they're very good baked. So to me, it's kind of like a raw preparation, but they go really well with cheese, with nuts, with, you know, other fatty things like yogurt. They're delicious for breakfast, drizzled with honey, with granola. I mean, I love persimmons. I wish they were more popular.
I applaud Joseph living in the moment, picking up a case of persimmons, honestly, Joseph, on the way home.
Yeah, let me know next time you're thinking of doing that. I'll go halvesies with you. But you can also gift them. I think it's funny to like get a lot of a piece of produce or a case of produce, and every time you meet with a friend, just give them a persimmon.
Brian is calling on line 3 from Nyack. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. You have a pretty straightforward question.
Pretty straightforward. I just made a lentil curry dish, and it came out delicious, except my lentils, no matter how long I cooked it, they did not soften up. They were very al dente.
Yeah. You know, much like dried beans, if you have dried legumes or pulses and they're old, they have a very hard time cooking through. It's kind of like anything that's freshness related. We don't think of a dried bean or a dried lentil as needing to be fresh, but you really do. And sometimes you don't know how long it's been sitting on a shelf or even in your own cupboard. It's important that if you think it's never going to happen, if, you know, it's been like an hour and a half, it's never going to happen. And that's okay. If it's still delicious, it might be harder to digest that way. But, you know, from there, you can kind of, I've had that same issue where I just keep cooking, keep adding water, keep cooking. And I'm like, you know what? It's never going to happen for this bean. This bean is never going to cook.
Sometimes you have to face the bean music.
Yeah. So just make sure you're getting them from a place where you think there's a high turnover. You know.
Actually, we have somebody who's got a tip about the beans who called in.
Bean tip.
I love Marion from Brooklyn on line 8. Our listeners help each other.
I love it.
And I have a very useful procedure that I use all the time, no matter what legume I'm cooking. I soak them overnight in clear water. Then I cook them in the soaking water, and I add a piece of kombu and a bouquet garni, and I add some additional water and cook them. And it helps to make them much more digestible. There's something about that kombu. And then you remove the kombu after they're cooked.
Amazing. I'm sure that also adds some nice salinity and flavor to the liquid as well. I love that.
It doesn't add a lot of flavor because you're just using a small square of it. But the bouquet garni really does make that bean, what they call bean water, into a lovely vegetable stock that I always use when in the recipe that I'm making.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the tip. Let's go to Elaine in Manhattan on line 1. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you? I have a question regarding pork chops. I'm making a recipe over the weekend, and I've eaten pork, but I've never cooked them like pork chops.
Mm.
So what, when I go to the supermarket to get my ingredients, what cut of pork chops should I seek out?
It depends. What kind of pork chop recipe are you looking for?
What kind? The kind that you see sliced.
Okay, so just like a steak, but a pork. You want like a nice thick chop.
Right.
Yeah.
Something that tends not to toughen up.
Exactly. So I like to use a bone-in loin chop for that. And, you know, the reason I like that is because you can ask for the thickness. And so, you know, a 1 or 2 bone chop is going to be about an inch and a half, sometimes pushing 2 inches thick, which will feed more than 2 people. But you cook it like a steak. And I like that pork medium rare. And it's safe to eat, and it stays really juicy and delicious. And the thicker the chop, the harder it is to overcook. So for anyone looking for that kind of experience, I always say thicker is better. And if you can order your pork from a butcher or, you know, speak to the people behind the butcher counter, ask for what you need and say inch and a half. And when they cut it, like ask to see it and make sure that that's really the thickness. You'll have a much better time, and it won't dry out. It'll be fantastic.
I think Chris on line 6 may stump you, possibly. Uh-oh. Chris,
hello?
Hit me.
Hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have friends in the Adirondacks, and we help each other a lot. And in thanks for some help I gave them, one of my friends gave me a pretty good amount of bear meat and venison. And I don't know how to cook these things, and I want to do them justice. Have you got any suggestions?
You know, I wish I did. I am not the woman for the job for this. I've never eaten bear and I've never cooked it. But venison, I would say that I have cooked, and I've cooked it almost like red meat. So depending on the cut, it makes excellent stew. So kind of a one for one. It's a bit leaner than beef, so you have to compensate for fat in other areas, you know, by adding more olive oil or something like that, or maybe cutting it with another meat or adding bacon to your base. But I think, I mean, venison stew is delicious. I've also had the loin, the venison loin cooked almost like a pork tenderloin.
That's the cut that I have. It's a loin.
Yeah.
Of venison.
You know, I just season with salt and pepper and then sear until it's really nicely browned on all sides and let it rest like a steak and then eat it medium rare. It's awesome.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome. Good luck with the bear.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about this. You wrote in your column, most people assume, based on what I do for a living, that I must have an extraordinary kitchen full of the latest tools and appliances. I am a true kitchen Luddite.
Yes.
That you have a real simple kitchen. What's in your kitchen?
Oh, my gosh. A hilariously small stove. You would lie. It's smaller than, it's like the size of this microphone. My refrigerator is almost as small as that. It's constantly packed. It's like I put one wine bottle in and I can't fit anything else in there. Yeah, my kitchen is very bare bones, very basic. I have a lot of stuff because I, you know, use it to shoot with like five different skillets, but it's really just for visual, you know, variance. But if it were up to me and I were stocking my own kitchen, all I need is, you know, a skillet, a sheet pan, tongs, a whisk. I don't use fancy tools. I'm not a person who needs equipment, like anything specialty. I don't own an Instant Pot. I don't own an air fryer. I think you can make complete magic with a Dutch oven. And a heat source. And I think that's kind of all you need. But yeah, I just kind of have an aversion to all that stuff. I think also I'm trying to make recipes for everybody, mm-hmm. and everybody should have at least those things. And so I don't want to alienate anyone by saying, well, you need a food processor or you need a this. Although one of my more popular recipes was for a salted butter chocolate chunk shortbread, which you do need a mixer for. But enough people, I guess, own one of those.
Allison Roman has been my guest. You can find Allison's recipes and writing on the New York Times website and in Bon Appetit magazine. Her 2017 book is called Dining In. Allison, you were a lot of fun. Will you come back?
I would love to come back.
Excellent. And listeners, thank you for your calls and for your suggestions. We've written them down. We'll tweet them out so we can help each other.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Coming up, a look at the Black History Month programming at the Schomburg. Stay with us.